Welcome back to the Buck Starts Here Season 2 podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. Last time we finished up Eric Mason's wild Van Buren ride, which means that today we finally get to move on to Mr. Harrison. Do you hear that? Ooh, that sounds pretty bad. Maybe we should move.
Should I give a 3-hour speech?
Move inside. Oh, okay. I think today we're going to get to learn about John Tyler then.
Oh, quick. I have an 8,400 word speech. Can I give that real quick?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Now, these jokes will definitely get better as we get deeper into this episode.
They will not. Don't let Kyle lie to you. They may only get worse.
Right. I'm Kyle, the broken guide rails to the roller coaster contained in Eric's notebooks. Remember to like, sub, comment on your platform of choice because your minimal effort goes a long way in helping us grow that show. Eric, you apparently have more than one episode for Mr. Harrison.
I do. I think he is the greatest PR man to ever sit in the Oval Office.
Yeah, Tippecanoe?
Tippecanoe and Tyler, too, because we're going to cover. So the third episode, I've been pitching to Kevin,
Kevin?
I have somebody named Kevin on this side of the screen on my notes.
That felt like a SpongeBob joke.
I've been talking to this homeless man, Kevin. I've been talking to Kyle about this. That the third episode, I want to be making a president because the PR around the Battle of Tippecanoe is unbelievable. That made a president. It is great. I think we do a disservice, William Henry Harrison, because we don't talk about him. We just skip over him in school. We're like, we think he had, he spoke too long in the cold. And then died.
Yeah.
By the way, that's not what a lot of people think he died of. He died of pneumonia, but it probably wasn't from the speech.
Ooh.
It's very, very, very gross. And there's a little economic lesson in here, too. Oh, there's a little contemporary economics going on.
So you're telling me I wasted all that time on this storm clip that I made?
Oh, no. It was definitely absolutely poor. Okay. He was definitely was not helped. An older gentleman at that time was not helped. So I'm sitting down getting ready to write this episode. And just to be 100% transparent, I was kind of already on the Tyler episodes because I find Tyler's kind of an interesting cat. He's going to be fun to talk about. Plus, there's always that good, like, the 10th president still has grandkids alive today. I think his grandkids are still alive today. So I was like, I am going to try and figure out what I would have wanted to learn about William Henry Harrison when I was in, like, 7th grade and we're trying to memorize the presidents.
Oh, okay.
And I thought back, I actually don't think it's on that shelf. I have my 7th grade textbook.
Oh my god.
So I don't think I put it back, but
I want to look through that when I come visit.
Yes, dude. And it is funny because there is actually more on him than I remembered naturally, but it's really just short and they don't really talk about his presidents being influential, which is bizarre because he was the first person elected of his political party. He was the first Whig ever elected.
This wasn't just that, but this is also like trying to counter Jacksonian politics. So like how he got elected is going to be really interesting too, right?
Oh, yeah. And that's going to be episode 2, is that his election and then into, a few weeks in office. Because you never get covered.
How many episodes do you have?
I have 3 episodes.
3 episodes for 4-week president. That's pretty impressive. Yeah, it's got to be a new record.
Yeah, it has to be. It's like we are scraping the barrel on this guy.
Oh my god, what's going to happen when we get to FDR? It's going to be like a year.
It's going to be Eric just sweating. but what happened is that what we don't try and do on this episode is give you like a holistic, complete view of the president. We assume you know something about the presidents. We're trying to tell you fun stuff that's interesting. But nobody ever learned anything about William Henry Harrison. So I was how about we just have a conversation of how this guy won? How this guy defeated Jacksonian Democrats?
How did he get past populism? Yeah,
you went from Andrew Jackson getting nominated 3 years before the presidential election, when Tennessee nominated him 3 years before when he actually ran for president the second time, to Van Buren being a one-term president. Like, getting defeated by William Henry Harrison, a man who was kind of made fun of a lot. He was made up like, he just wants like a hard cider and to be in the log cabin. And like, they were like, yeah, he does. Who doesn't want to have hard cider and just relax in their cabin? And that was like their campaign. We're going to get into that in episode 2. What I found out is that we're starting from scratch. Nobody knows anything about William Henry Harrison. They probably know more about William Henry Harrison from that episode of Parks and Rec where they go to the William Henry Harrison Museum. That's a great episode, by the way.
I don't think I've seen that one either.
It's a top tier episode. Kyle, you got a flight coming up. But he's an interesting guy. He's legitimately an interesting guy. He is the first real Ulysses S. Grant Eisenhower type president.
When you say Ulysses, oh, what do you mean by that? When you say war hero, or do you mean like
great general?
General, okay.
Yeah, you could argue that Jackson was a general too, but I think Jackson.
I think he was a general. He was more of I think what made him appeal, it was not his leadership, but more like his rank and file. Like he was like the grizzled sergeant that you follow into battle.
Yeah, he was more a populist. He was a general, but he won on his grizzled everyday manship.
Not necessarily his generalship.
Yeah, where William Henry Harrison won because people were like, I would like to elect a war hero. And that is mixed into the ethos of the American presidency because we all look back to Washington, that great general. So it's kind of playing off that this idea that the Americans want to elect a general.
So what and war was he fighting in? When do we get into that? Because
just before, he fought in a bunch of wars, and we're going to go through his entire, his military. He has one of the most impressive military resumes of all time.
Isn't he also considered one of the smartest or most intelligent presidents we've had too?
He was very, very intelligent.
How do we know that?
We don't really know. It's hard to test how smart somebody is. A lot of times you look at how they write is usually the metric they use. There's a bunch of different methodologies.
Just measuring vocabulary size or?
Well, vocabulary, complexity of thought, that's why, a lot of people, John Quincy Adams is, why they regard as being the smartest president of all time.
Just because he has letters full of satire?
Yeah, well, it's also just because, he's just a savant. Also, knowing, eight languages. At a certain point, okay, you're just smarter than us, Mr. Adams. he should have just been president the rest of his life. We should have just had
him. No. Bad.
I do like John Quincy Adams. Hey, we didn't have term limits yet.
No, that's...
He would have stepped down after two, knowing John Quincy Adams. Yeah. He would have been like, I would like to go back to being an attorney and defending.
Do you think he really even wanted it the second time? No, he didn't campaign. I mean, that is the guy you want in charge.
Yeah, right. That's the Cincinnatus, right? That's the guy who doesn't want to be here. Is probably the best guy to have there.
Yeah.
All right. So, let's start with William Henry Harrison's life. So he's born February 9th, 1773. So he was born
during the Revolution then. Okay.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, okay. Yeah. He's a lot older when he comes to office. So he's born on the Berkeley Plantation. That's in Charles City County, Virginia. And he's the youngest signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Harrison V. So Benjamin Harrison, the president during the Gilded Age, is William Henry Harrison's, I believe, his grandson. Named after Benjamin Harrison V. And I tried to find this. Was Benjamin Harrison the president? Was he secretly Benjamin Harrison VI? Because that would have been awesome. Or it could have been the 7th.
I think it just broke my brain with that little convoluted. Hopefully we get some graphs up here that kind of show that family tree.
Yeah. we should actually do that. It'd be working fun.
Yeah.
But here's the cool thing. So we talk about this great military general. And so I'm going through it. I'm expecting him to come from this big military family. No, diplomatic family, well-educated. and he's sent, when he's around 14, 15 years old, he gets sent to school. And he gets sent to Hampden-Sydney College. And, he basically went to college, effectively did what we would call prereqs. Got that squared away. And he left without a degree. No, he was not partying. He wasn't an idiot or anything like that. Just like Kyle said, he just did 2 years of school. Two and a half years of school. And one of the best evidence of people are like, oh, you don't know that, Eric. And I'm like, I said the same thing when I was reading historians. How do they know he wasn't a party animal? Well, because he immediately started training to become a doctor. I was like, oh, okay, maybe he is pretty sharp.
Sounds like he went to school, figured out what he wanted to be, and then he went to go to pursue that.
And, so he goes to, he didn't really know, it's kind of funny because he didn't really know what he wanted to do. And so he's from this, he grew up in a plantation, but it was very like how Monroe grew up. It was I guess you could almost call it middle class, upper middle class, not gentry class. He wasn't Madison. He wasn't Jefferson.
Yeah. He wasn't eating off of a golden spoon.
Yeah, exactly. And so he ends up going and studying medicine under a very familiar name that we talked about earlier in the series, Benjamin Rush, Dr. Benjamin Rush.
Oh, God, why don't we know that name?
Yeah.
What is it?
So he pioneered, like, everything. Like, he was, like, this American okay. doctor who he pioneered everything from, you know, like, bloodletting at the time to psychiatry. He's actually called the father of American psychiatry. The Dickinson College, which is, like, this famous college in Carlisle. He was the first kind of, like, doctor of public health. And he was really kind of like America's first doctor. And I think one of the funniest things about, you know, history is everybody kind of knows each other. And it's weird to hear that he studied under this doctor who was also, in terms of public health, though, inoculation, Mrs. Adams, like, he was a public health expert. And that's where we talked about earlier, was that Benjamin Rush at this time was talking about, like, inoculation. Well, later on, this was about this time, 1790s. He started talking about, you know, the idea of inoculating people and was obviously very influential on the Adamses' life. Because I will bring up the Adamses in every single episode ever.
That was a gift that I actually wanted to bring you. I was going to try to make my own smallpox inoculation kit with an X-Acto knife and a little vial.
Eric checked us out. It's like, oh, Kyle, it's supposed to be cowpox. Like, that'll feel so good. So why do we have General William Henry Harrison instead of Dr. William Henry Harrison?
To be honest with you, I never really put together the war hero connection. I never knew he was even in the military.
Oh, William Henry Harrison?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, we are gonna get
like my knowledge of this guy
in on this dude.
The only thing I know about is how he died. That's about it. And even that apparently is wrong.
What everybody knows about
it. I know, right?
Well, why did he abandon medicine?
Mm-hmm.
It's a reoccurring story. His father died when he was young.
So another.
His father passed away. He started medical studies in 1790. His father passes away shortly after.
Is he a widower too?
Harrison turns 18. So, what'd you say?
Is he a widower too?
No, he wasn't a widower. I don't believe. Okay. So I didn't see anything on all that. Right.
Just trying to get that ratio back.
We're trying to at least get a 50-50. Yeah. So his father dies in 1791, just shortly after William Henry Harrison turns 18. And so now he comes back to the plantation. Now what's key here is, again, this is not what we think of a Jefferson-style plantation. Still horrible. It's still owning people. That's not being dismissive. It wasn't as economically profitable. That is what I mean when I say it wasn't as good or as bad as the plantation. I'm not referring to the horrific act of slaves being involved. I'm saying, like, was it making money or not? And right. This was not something that was heavy profit generation, which is kind of messed up. Like, oh, you're committing this horrible moral black spot, and you're, like, not even making that much money? Like, what are you doing, dude?
What's the point? Yeah, you're just, you're just lazy.
You're just lazy. That's it. You're like, what a jerk. At that point, just like, free your slaves, at least be on the right side of history and humanity.
Yeah, right.
So he leaves and he decides to join the Navy. So he becomes a actually, let me rephrase that. He joins the military. That's how it's fine. But he gets commissioned as an ensign, which obviously is related to the Navy.
Ensign.
What did I call it? Second on the ensign?
Yeah.
Okay. Laura?
Help. I mean, we always called it ensigns when I was in the military, I'm going to go with that one, probably.
So he ends up joining the U.S. military at the time. This is kind of like just after, it's like revolutionary military. So, but he ends up serving completely in the army, his career, but he becomes an ensign. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So he becomes an ensign. He gets commissioned. Are ensigns NCOs?
Ensigns are commissioned.
Are they officers?
Yeah, it's like the lowest rank officer, but it is an officer. So that should have been his commission. Should have been being an ensign.
Okay, I gotta look. I have a footnote here where I got that from, and I'm pretty sure. I wonder if the author who wrote that didn't understand what an NCO was.
I think that's probably likely
because they wrote NCO, but then they wrote commissioned ensign.
That's not an NCO. An NCO would be a non-commissioned officer.
It wouldn't have a commission. So I'm gonna.
Yeah,
that book.
Well, I don't know how that works in that seven or whenever this time frame was, though. Things might have been different.
Yeah. So he gets commissioned at Fort Washington, which is Cincinnati. So he's sitting in Cincinnati. He's like, all right. He ends up serving there till 1794. And then he joins the Legion of the United States. So this is when you can kind of talk about him being a that's kind of like the proper United States military.
Go back just a second. You said he was an ensign and he served in Cincinnati?
Yes.
It's bizarre, but okay.
Okay. No, he served at – he was stationed at Fort Washington.
Yeah. For how long?
He leaves – he joins the Legion of the United States in 1792. He leaves there in probably around 1794.
So a couple of years – maybe he's going to school there?
Yeah, I don't –
because he's young. I mean, right?
Yeah, he's really young. He's 18 at this point.
Oh, so do you ever read like the Horatio Hornblower novels?
No.
So like there was a practice of like kids like be very young age like going into the Navy and getting commissioned as officers and like going up and
see I've always Kyle I'm happy you brought that up because something I found very interesting when I was looking through some biographies every biography says it's the same that he was commissioned as an ensign half of them will then immediately use the term United States military half of them will use the term United States Army but it's 1791 so the U.S. Army's formed They say they formed in 1775, but I'm not sure when the uniform like their uniform codes came out.
Right.
So, but like if you read some other stuff, though, because they use the term ensign, there's these Navy references. And if we remember from our show on the Battle of 1812, the War of 1812, there are naval detachments, naval units, naval people stationed at some of these forts, especially forts with cannons. And so I don't know if this was one of those examples where it was like, hey, he's going to be using artillery. Well, where's the biggest artillery in the world? It's on ships. And they're just using that terminology because he's getting that type of specialized training.
Right.
This is where some of the history side becomes interesting. And then, unfortunately, there's just not that much stuff written on William Henry Harrison. So, like, you're only referencing that stuff.
How old was he when he signed up?
He was only 14? 18. That's the 18? Other weird part. Yeah.
Was this after he'd gone to school already? Did he already have...
Yep, so after he dropped out of medical training, he went home and was like, oh, I need to find, like, a career. Yeah. And it gets kind of vague if he was like, it'll take too long to become a doctor. Or he was like, I know I can join the military. So he went and just got commissioned.
Yeah. I wonder what that's like getting commissioned because I would have imagined there'd have to be some sort of education being done. Like, so maybe the time he spent in Cincinnati was like actually like getting trained on how to be an officer because you don't just come in as an officer, I don't think, right?
So
at least these days you need a school or education, a degree.
Yeah, unless you're one of those mavericks, which is, I always think it's the coolest thing in the world. I was so good at this, they made me an officer. But exactly right. So he actually gets assigned to the 1st Infantry Regiment. So when he's with the Legion of the United States, and he served under General Wayne. And this is kind of interesting. So there was a kind of like a frontiers battle. Yeah, it was a mixture of British troops and Native American tribes. And you know, this is that kind of interlude period where it's like, okay, well, America won this war, but we got to negotiate it, but we still have Canada up there, and there's still all this influence. And you got the French are there, so like the Brits like are like, I don't want to like open up the war again because I don't want to risk French influence, but I also can't have like I want to push back against the Northwest expansion because like at this point the Northwest Ordinance is coming into being, so like Ohio is going to join the United States, and the Brits up in Canada are like, that's getting a little too close, but I kind of want to maybe instead of me fighting you, I can pay some mercenaries to go fight you.
Maybe get some Indians to occupy all these forts.
Yeah,
some
exactly.
Native Americans to occupy all these forts.
Long story short, he actually ends up getting promoted quite quickly to lieutenant. So he gets promoted to lieutenant by 1794. So he's a full board officer at this point. Because, as you know, ensign's kind of I don't want to call it like a mezzanine officer, like a mezzanine position going into an officer. But this is, he's now a lieutenant. He's fully in the army now. There's not that kind of like, oh, what is he? What isn't he in there?
Yeah. He's probably getting like real commands now at this point where he's like getting large numbers of troops to control or command, not just divisions.
Exactly. So now we start moving forward. So you end up with as we talked about the Confederacy Wars, the Native American Confederacy Wars that we talked about that all the way back with Mr. Washington. Mm-hmm. He ends up being at Fort Washington. He's still serving under Major General Wayne and is there when they decisively defeat the Native American Confederacy. And this was a huge thing. Like, I don't know if I did a good job talking about the ramifications of this back when we first covered, because I think I was covering it from like the 10,000 foot view. This is huge. This scares the crap out of the Brits. The Brits are like, oh, damn. Oh, wait, they're actually good at fighting. like, they are. Oh, that wasn't just like us losing a battle because we were 2,000.
Lucky. Yeah.
Yeah, they maneuvered and won a frontier war, which, as you know, fighting a frontier war where you're fighting the people who you're fighting live in that area and being able to get a decisive victory. Like, the Native American Confederacy never stands up again.
There's no front lines. Like, there's no, like, traditional, like, the way you think of, like, battle. Like, you're having to, like, find probably small pockets of troops, that guerrilla warfare style. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is a prelude to what ends up happening at the Battle of Tippecanoe. And Mr. Henry Harrison becomes known to be very good at fighting in these types of environments. Well, after the, on August 20th, 1794, at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, we see the complete holistic defeat of the Native Confederacy. We see the Brits never fully, until later on, withdraw their support. You don't really start seeing that until like after the War of 1812. So like you don't see that until like 1815. You still see a little bit of it, but they fully withdraw that immediate year. They withdraw. They're like, hey, we didn't think the Americans would be able to do this. And it actually leads to Ohio becoming a state, because the Americans were able to consolidate authority, control over the Northwest Territory. And so this is a big reason why Ohio exists, is because William Henry Harrison's, and it should be really Major General Wayne, but at this time, Lieutenant Harrison was just very skilled. Mm-hmm. And he was just a very good leader of men. Well, so after the Battle of Fallen Timbers, and this is where a lot of times we talk about this, like, it's almost like, hey, the war kind of dies down. And a lot of presidents stop fighting. They go and become politicians. So he doesn't really. He actually keeps serving. Every so often, there's another flare up in the territory. Did the Brits flare it up? Probably. Like, I don't know. I'm just an Occam's razor guy.
Only three choices to pick from. Is it the French Canadians, the British Canadians, or the Native Americans? So
yeah.
One of those three.
Yeah, I think they were just paying the Native Americans to just attack Americans.
They were doing it before. They did Spanish it for like 30 years. Everyone's been doing it, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's weird to just like feel like, no.
Native Americans got guns somehow.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, so he ends up doing a great job of this, and he goes from a lieutenant in 1795, and by 1797, records show that he becomes a captain. And he's getting his promotions, not, you know, sitting in a rare office or, you know, doing clerical work. He's out there winning battles.
He's getting and keeping field his promotions. Troops
safe. Yeah, they're field promotions.
Gosh,
And so afterwards, he's like, he ends up kind of realizing that he really loves this idea of like service. He has this like, I like helping these people. I like being like this area I'm talking about. He's in the Northwest Territory, so he's in what's like modern day, like Ohio, Indiana, and that stuff.
You're not talking about as a leader of men. He just, I really like helping these people by shooting them all dead.
No. But he likes the idea of like, oh wow, he sees what he's doing, and he's like, oh look at like he sees the benefit of like this consolidation of power and stuff like that, and
Just controlling the waterway of the Mississippi, having access down to basically New Orleans. Like, that's huge. Yeah,
it's pretty important. as he's getting promoted to captain, he takes a quick side quest. He ends up marrying Anna Smythe.
Smythe? Is this our second Smythe?
The second Smythe, yeah.
That's a weird name.
Not related. I did look this up.
That's just a popular name at the time.
So he ends up, marrying marrying Anna. And from everything I could read, they had a great relationship. They were,
How do you spell Smythe?
S-Y-M-M-E-S.
M-M-E-S.
That's a last name that kind of died out. That stinks. That's a cool last name.
Is that Smythe or is that Sims?
So the pronunciation I saw when I went on YouTube pronounced it Smize.
That's a weird way of saying that. Yeah.
Yeah, there is a Sims pronunciation of it. I just don't know. I'm going to be honest with you. I'll be honest with the audience. It's pronounced it's differently pronounced based on where the name came from.
Ah.
I don't know where.
One of those. Okay. That makes
so
sense.
I made an educated guess that it was pronounced that way.
I wanted to see what the name means. And oh, okay, that makes sense. So it's like a
Scottish
form of the name Simon.
Yeah, is it Scottish or something?
They say it's in English origins, meaning it's Simon or Simi or something like that. But
so
basically, it stands for he who is heard or he who hears.
So the reason you might be reading the same thing I did. So the reason I saw the pronunciation for Simes was it's from the name Simon.
Yeah, Simon.
So
yeah.
It's that same.
But it's also a Hebrew version, which is Shimeon or something like that.
So I've seen that before.
Yeah. Ah, that's okay. I didn't mean to take us on a digression into names.
It was something I have a little footnote. If I click on it, it takes me to the pronunciation. So I was like, I
love it when we're on the same page on those.
No, because it's confusing when you look at the words. You're like, is that Sims?
Yeah.
So they get married at North Bend, which is near Cincinnati at the time. And I think one of my favorite things, he has 10 kids. they just have, from everything I read, they have an awesome marriage.
Apparently.
They're just it's very much he's this not an aristocrat. He grew up
what was his religion?
I don't know. I don't really look into their religions that often.
Because aren't they mostly all Protestant?
Oh yeah. We don't have a Catholic president until
JFK.
Yeah, they're all. A lot of times, depends on. A lot of times, you can just look at where their family immigrated here from, and then are they Episcopalian, are they Presbyterian, are they some form of Anglicanism. So they have 10 kids. One of them's obviously John Scott Harrison, who's the father of Benjamin Harrison, which goes back to my theory that Benjamin Harrison should be called Benjamin Harrison VI. I will campaign on that. So he starts a family. He's doing good. He's a captain. I think it's kind of cool because, again, we're not taught a lot about this president, about William Henry Harrison, but to see him as a person, right? He's a man whose father died during a formative period, had to leave school, want to take care of his family, joins the military. I think that's a pretty common story today. I think we all have buddies who are similar to that. Maybe some people listening here went through that process. And he goes out, ends up loving the military, finding a lot of success in there, finds somebody he loves, and is he's still a captain. By the way, this is 1795, this goes on. So he still serves for 3 more years. And, he has his wife, they're starting a family, he's going out there, he's leading men, he's being successful, he's ensuring that the Northwest Territory is safe, not just from, not just safe from Native Americans, but from British intervention. Mm-hmm. I mean, in reality, his success on the battlefield is a lot. I mean, captains are very, very important. Army captains, I know freaking Navy guy is going to scream at me. So, no, he's not a colonel. I know captains are higher up. but he's kind of just having that life you expect. He's in his, by this time he's 25. He's doing good. And then an opportunity happens. John Adams, the father of John Adams, actually makes a request to him and asks, do you want to become the secretary of the Northwest Territory?
What?
Yeah. And he's really? And he's a captain at this time. So he's not super high up, but he's made a name for himself. He's doing good. And he agrees.
Does that come with a promotion? I don't think he'd be a captain in charge of the Northwest Territories.
No, he has to. This is something that kind of. There's not a lot of at the time records of it, but I think this kind of maybe broke his heart a little bit. He has to leave the military because the military is civilian controlled, so you can't be in the military in a civilianly appointed position. So he's like, I love the Northwest Territory. I love all this stuff. He fought really hard for it. He spent a lot of his life. His family's out there now. And he's like, I'll accept it. And he becomes a secretary of the Northwest Territory. Now, a secretary of a territory at this point is really high up. It's like they only talk to one person. They only report to one person. That's the governor. So they're
okay,
the chief,
ask where, yeah, okay.
So, yeah, they're the chief administrative officer. So they're basically the guy who runs the entire show. The governor handles the politics of it. Of that
interesting
side.
That they still have a governor as a territory.
Yeah, that's actually kind of strange. That'll, by the way, that'll pop it set up. We'll get some cool side stories post Civil War on that. You'll get some, there's some cool stuff that happens over there, because you can ask yourself, what side are these, a lot of these territories, what side of the war are they on? And what happened to their governors afterwards?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, it's a good question. When you're not a state and you don't have a ratified constitution, you don't get to decide. You don't have a constitution, man. You don't know how elections work. Maybe the side that you just tried to secede from might want to have some words with you in your governorship. Those will be some fun 10 minute episodes as we run through what happened to every governor of Confederate.
Just make a list and we'll just go through them all.
Yeah. Wow. It seems like they all came out of office at the exact same time.
This is so weird.
What a quinkadink.
They did.
So Mr. Harrison's in charge of all land, all the militia, and basically the probate office, a record keeping office, a registry of deeds for not just all of Ohio, but everything that makes up the Northwest Territory. So he rules.
Dude, that's like a lot of, that's like five states worth up there, isn't it? Or even more than that, maybe.
Yeah, but it touches, I think, five states. Northwest Territory low-key is enormous. I think some people don't realize like how big of an area that was, because it looks small compared to when we start talking about Manifest Destiny, it looks small compared to like Utah and Arizona, Nevada and New Mexico. But like, it's a big area. It's decent size, especially compared to how big states were at the time.
If I get a map of it right here in my face. Yeah, okay. So, it covers Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota.
Yeah.
That's massive.
That's massive.
It's like a fifth of the U.S. almost.
Yeah, so he's in charge of all of that.
Yeah.
From everything we possibly know, he was excellent at it.
Yeah.
There were no
problems from the Northwest Territories during this time?
No, there was problems, but he managed it well. But here's where Harrison started. The Whig Party didn't exist yet.
Yeah.
Actually, at this point, the Democratic-Republican Party doesn't really even exist.
Not really, no.
He's just a good administrator, dude. The people like him. He's well-liked. He's considered fair. He's considered very effective. He's well-respected. Kudos to Governor St. Clair. Governor St. Clair is like super supportive. He's like, no, this guy's a great administrator. And he really, I think this is also why he was so good of a technician, of a tactician when he was on the battlefield. He just gets systems. He's very smart. He understands how things work. Dude. He knows how to optimize.
Honestly, the majority of like being a good, successful leader is just understanding logistics. Like, if you can do logistics, like, you could be a pretty damn good commander. All you got to do is get the food and supplies to the people who need it.
Yeah, and so in 1799, he ends up being rewarded by the people of this huge piece of territory, and he gets sent to Congress as a non-voting delegate in the 6th Congress. Obviously, territorial representation doesn't have any voting power in Congress, but he gets to go there as a non-voting congressman.
Step up, though? I mean, like, what do you...
He's still heavily influenced. The affairs
operations
of the territory. And he ends up pressing for the liberalization of land, to attract more settlers. But he takes it a step further, and this is where obviously I think people know my economic leanings. I do like decentralization a lot. Harrison ends up pushing something called the Harrison Land Act, and this gets passed May 10th, 1800, and it championed reforms that lowered minimum parcel size, eased credit terms. And it broadened, broadened access and democratized access for landholders. So you could be some guy who maybe can't afford and maybe isn't able to manage.
I don't need 100 acres. Maybe I can get 5.
Exactly. People start flooding in here. It's really interesting. It's like he was like, no, we can democratize this. We shouldn't just reserve this to people who know how to do 1,000,000 acres or some of that. He was like, let's open this to everybody. And it's wildly popular. People are like, because having small means you can also have big. But if you only have big, you can't have small. So
You just in the previous thing that we recorded, talked a lot about how capital flows to the highest rate of return. I think that's a prime example of that right there.
Yep. Yeah. And later on in 1800, we have something called the Indiana Territory is created. And that was largely championed by Harrison too. And I think I don't have a direct source for this, but reading enough about Harrison over this time period, I thought it was smart. Harrison was like, if you want to be a state, you start acting like a state. That was his logic on stuff.
Brilliant.
And so push for the creation of Indiana, and it passes, and people are like, oh, this Harrison guy, he's well-spoken, he's apparently, like, I never saw him overly described as, like, charismatic, right? I never, you don't see that in there, but by every metric, this dude seems to be very likable.
Getting stuff done, yeah.
Very likable and considered very intelligent. So now what ends up happening is you start to see the really big rise of William Henry Harrison. So May 13th, 1801, President Adams, just before he leaves office, signs an appointment, actually appoints appoints William Henry Harrison to be the governor of the Indiana Territory. And he's also, concurrently that, the superintendent of Indian Affairs, who is reappointed under Jefferson. So Adams is like, I want you to be the head of the Indiana Territory. And then Jefferson, at the time, mortal enemies with Adams, was like, you're really good at your job. You're also the superintendent of Indian Affairs.
And that just speaks to the competence of some of these people, yeah.
Yeah. So between 1803 and 1809, he's still in civil governorship. Life. Yeah, governorship. He ends up negotiating all these land treaties with Native Americans, Fort Wayne, Grouseland, and
another. You're saying negotiated, are these like Jacksonian type negotiations? Are these like more, what's the right term? Like more.
It's controversial.
Honest?
Yeah, okay. It's controversial. Well, yeah. It is. It were these fair treaties. Now, at the time, probably. I don't know if that's a little speculatory. The problem a lot of times with the Native American negotiations was, I think, something that has always been a problem when it comes to negotiating with the history of the United States negotiating some of these contracts, which is we've just view land ownership differently, right?
Yeah, than completely different tribes. Cultures. Yeah.
Right. So you can think you're doing an honest deal, but right. Both sides aren't communicating, don't know the communication they're making. And then, like, I look at it this way. Like, I try and put myself in the shoes of somebody who maybe has a different view of how land rights work, where you're just like, what's going on? Like, okay, are you asking me if you can use the land that we all use? Like, yeah, sure. What is this?
Right, deed? Right.
And then somebody's like, oh, no, it means you can't use it. It's like, well, that'd be a weird concept if that's not a concept you're used to.
Yeah, especially if that's not explained. And then you also got language barriers on top of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also, like, who represents the tribe, right? Like,
right, right.
If you, we try, you know, we do a horrible job, but we try and, like, deduce tribe that assume that every indigenous tribe has the exact same structure. And it's like, no, they don't. Like, every tribe has a different structure. No, we should respect that.
Majority of the time, it seems like you just grab whoever's associated with that tribe who will sign the paper.
There's been examples, like, and we covered them in earlier episodes, of, you know, the United States sitting down negotiating a treaty and everybody being happy, and then the tribe being like, that guy doesn't represent us, it's just some random dude who just like walked over to you.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's fair. That is a bad thing. We should have vetted who has the authority to do this. We should negotiate with people who have the ability to negotiate. That seems like a base one thing you start with. but yeah, so he negotiates these treaties. They are a flashpoint. But it is interesting because I don't, again, there's no such thing as a good treaty at this time. But do I think William Henry Harrison was doing it the way Jackson
good faith.
Was?
I'm sorry. Was he doing it in good faith? I think was what I was
I think he was. I just think the system was flawed.
Yeah.
I think it's driving down the wrong side of the highway. Like, you can be a good driver, but you're on the wrong side of the highway. You're still, you know, you can be the best driver you want. You're still doing something wrong.
Right, right.
But he negotiates these treaties all the way up until the Fort Wayne Treaty of 1809. Which was just before we saw the Tecumseh Crisis, which is where, you know, the Battle of Tippecanoe really cements Mr. Harrison in his position. So, but between, you know, him becoming those land treaties and, you know, him rejoining the military, we see him build Grouseland, which is the governor's which is where the governor's mansion was, and really turned that area into the economic and political hub of the Northwest Territory. So he ends up becoming this, like, cool. He's such an executive. He really has this idea of efficiency. Yeah. So it kind of becomes this area where people, representatives from all over the Northwest Territory, can engage in productive governorship. And it was never intended to do that. This isn't like a capital or anything. It's a governor's mansion. But it's William Henry Harrison. So he was like, no, let's be efficient. What do you need? How do we fix this? I often wonder, I'm like, if that was all one state, would it have been like wicked efficient if it was just run by this one dude who's like, no, I just like serving people and I'm a very good administrator. It's like, yeah, can you just be in office the entire time, please?
To be honest, I'd be kind of curious to see what happened if that would have been the one that seceded from the Union. Like, yeah, right. See what they would have done after 100 years.
Very It's very efficient.
Why is the Midwest?
It's not
so
a slavery
efficient?
Issue. They just want to be their own. Right?
Yeah, we just need to cut some of this red tape.
Free states. We have one guy. Everybody kind of likes him. And he seems like a good dude. So,
seems to know what he's doing. So we're just going to ride with this for as long
as we
can.
We're just going to see how long this can last. Shortly after signing or finalizing the Fort Wayne Treaty, which was the last land treaty he was involved with prior to going back to the military, something called the Tecumseh Crisis. Tecumseh was a very famous Native American leader and also military leader. Mm-hmm. I almost said general, but I don't know if that's the proper term.
I don't think so.
I think chief was the term I was looking for. And this was kind of the rebirth of the Native American Confederacy we saw in the 1790s. Interesting note, if you're reading...
Is this the one that was trying to petition for Sequoia, or was that later?
I think that was later. Sure that was later.
Yeah, because that was like in the Oklahoma area.
This is further north than that.
Yeah.
Okay. I will say something a little, you know, me, I like little idiosyncrasies. When you see Native American Confederacy with a capital C, it usually refers to the tribal wars that took place during the ending of the American Revolution in the Western United States. And by Western United States, I mean like modern-day Ohio and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When it's a lowercase c, it usually just refers to a coalition of Native American tribes that coordinated their attacks. A little funny thing. We're gonna obviously circle back around because we're doing the bonus episode or the last episode on the Battle of Tippecanoe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this is where the Battle of Tippecanoe happens. Well, again, we'll go more into that, but...
Yeah, it gets the whole episode, yeah.
By August of 1892, so a year later, the Northwestern Command, which I still think is the coolest name of any... Like, you know, we have South Command and... August of 1812.
Okay, I thought you said 1892.
No, that'd be wild.
We do put forward quite a bit.
New conspiracy theory. This is kind of cool. So War of 1812 starts kicking off. It's August 1812. The Northwestern Command is basically, I don't want to say activated because it didn't exist, but they called up a bunch of U.S. reservists and mm-hmm. the Kentucky militia and also some federal regulars. So like, because remember at this time, we're still like kind of like anti-standing armies.
Yeah.
And they actually, Harrison was asked to be commissioned to command the entire army. Which is, I find kind of cool because he was a captain when he left.
Yeah,
like, captain, very high up, not leading armies. No, maybe leading 200 guys. Yeah, with a couple platoons.
Captain might get a larger group. They might get like a whole fort's worth.
Okay, maybe, but like still, maybe, like, but you're not a colonel, right? Not a general. Not an army. You're not like. Right. But so they call him up and they're like, "Yo, William Henry Harrison, would you like to be a general?" And he's like, "Oh." Yeah, sure.
I would.
He's like, I'm really efficient at logistics. He's like, no, we're very aware of that. You've run somehow something from Ohio to modern day Minnesota very efficiently, and it seems to be working fine. Also, it's very safe. It's like, not very safe. It's still the frontier, but like way safer than this should be. Right. Simultaneously, people are just like ransacking Georgia, which is a full state. Let's be very clear. The rest of the country at the time is just fighting border wars, and people are like, and you're bordering Britain. You're bordering
the country that we're about to fight.
Yeah, and he's somehow like, nah, I got everything worked out here.
They come into Detroit here pretty soon, don't they?
Oh, that's literally my next point. We have September 10th, 1813, and we are talking about the Oliver Hazard Perry's raid. That was a big victory.
All right. I recognize my notes.
And again, it's going to feel like we're speedrunning a lot of this, but it really, William Henry Harrison really goes like from in like course of like 11 years goes from like, oh, this guy a lot of politicians know because he's an effective administrator to like, you know, like we should elect him president. So what I wanted to do is paint why people wanted to be president. Why you probably would have voted for him.
I'd have like, voted for him. I'd vote for him now.
Yeah, like except for the sleeve thing. I was like,
it was from Virginia. Okay, yeah, he got me on that one.
You have the, you know, Hazard Perry's victory on Lake Erie, which severs supply lines. Now, classic General Harrison, right? He sees that supply line severing. He's like, good. The troops that are currently north of us that seem kind of like this impregnable wall, he's like, they have no supplies. I'm going to start attacking them. So he moves north and starts attacking them. And his whole idea was like, hey, they have no logistics.
Yeah.
Like, Perry just sunk all their stuff. It's almost winter. Nobody's bringing stuff from the north down to them. I'm going to attack them. Everybody's like, dude, what are you attacking them for? They're going to burn Detroit. They're going to attack. He's like, they're not going to burn Detroit. They're going to have to
because they have nothing to, like, they're going to be looting it maybe for supplies, but that's about all they can do.
So he's like, and he's like, the Brits are a professional military. They're not going to, they're not going to let Detroit get surrounded and us basically capture several regiments.
Right.
So he leaves. He sees what he gets alerted to what happens with Perry. September 10th, he leaves, makes it to Detroit, and by the end of September, Detroit has fallen. And here's the cool thing. They didn't destroy Detroit. The Brits were like, oh, we don't have supplies. It's starting to get cold. And they withdrew, and it was a tactical withdrawal. There wasn't a big battle.
Did they even know that they was coming, or they just leave on their own as soon as they know they didn't have supplies? Because that's probably what I would have done if I was in charge of them.
Yeah, so kind of what I was reading was they were like, okay, we're good if we don't have a military force leading up here because we have enough supplies in Detroit to last until resupply. And then they're like, oh, there's an army moving north here.
Yeah.
We can't fight this. Because they were also, I mean, it's British regulars. Like, they were well-trained.
No, they know what they're, yeah. They know what they need.
Like, yeah, they were like, oh, you know, this, they're like, at the
I'd
time.
I'd love to fight, but man, I'd really like some more bullets to be able to fire.
They're like, this is not a war of attrition type of battle. This is a frontier war. This is maneuver warfare. So they were like, not worth it. So they actually made it back to Canada before the winter set in. So it was a good move by them. So this is like end of September. Everything's kind of calm. But then October 5th rolls around and the Battle of the Thames, which is still my favorite name because you say the Battle of the Thames, people are going to be like, England? Like, no, it was in America.
There's another Thames?
Right? And Harrison routes this British / native force and he was serving.
Liberating Detroit seems like a better resume bullet to have on there than the Battle of Tippecanoe or whatever happened there.
It wasn't exciting at all because it was just he out-logistic'd them. He was a better administrator.
See, I find that a more satisfying victory, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and so he ends up he ends up defeating this combined British native force. Full circle, what comes around is that Tecumseh, who he fought some of his troops at the Battle of Tippecanoe, was killed in the fighting, which does actually end that version of the Native American Confederacy. Mm-hmm. And that was considered what actually broke the back of the British Native force in the area, the Battle of the Thames. Mm-hmm. And it was a decisive military victory. Like, this was not like, oh, I outfought you, I out-attritioned you. No, this was I outmaneuvered you, and I beat you, and I killed the leader of your ally. Like, I don't want to keep fighting. Like, that was the thing about Harrison. He was like, I don't want to pursue you. I mean, he's like, I'm maybe a guy who likes maneuver warfare, but I'm not maneuver warfare like, oh, let's go up into Canada. Like, I'm not the guy who went to York when modern day Toronto and burnt it down.
Right.
That's not William Henry. I don't think that'd be William Henry. Correct me wrong, people, but I don't think that's like a William Henry Harrison move. I think he'd be like, why am I up here? Like, my job's to defend my borders. That's all I want to do. He's the anti-Andrew Jackson. He's like, okay, overthrow some governors. It's like, why? Not what we're trying to do, dude.
Well, we could have had Canada if we would have.
Yeah. Well, here's what makes it crazy. Less than 2 years from being commissioned to lead the Northwestern Army, he resigns.
No kidding, really?
Yeah. So there was a lot of friction with the Secretary of War, this guy named John Armstrong, who decided afterwards to reorganize a bunch of the commands that Harrison led. And Harrison was like, nah, I'm good. So he resigns. And kind of cool, he didn't resign in protest. He didn't resign, get angry, anything like that. So he resigned with a commission honorably. It was an honorable discharge. He was just like, hey, like, I don't agree with this. So he resigns in 1814. And over the next 12-ish years, we see the rise of the political entity that is William Henry Harrison. At first, immediately after the war, he's elected to represent Ohio in Congress. He is very what does he push for? He pushes for balanced budgets, the expansion of frontier infrastructure to allow people to live there, strong supports veteran pensions. I mean, just stuff that's hard to disagree with.
All right, yeah.
After
how was this? Did we get into a stance on slavery yet? Because I kind of got the impression of being a Whig, he would have been on the abolition side of things, but was that not the case?
It evolves over time.
That's kind of what I figured.
He did have slaves, but it's not somebody who made his... I want to word this right, because I did look into it. Again, there's not that much written on his stance. Like, people didn't really think of what he was thinking about. So he grew up with slaves. Did it ever rise to the kind of levels that Jefferson had? Of course not. His father, you know, when he was born on the plantation, his father had 100 slaves people, and he inherited a small number of them. As an adult, he continued to own slaves, about a dozen. And then after he moved to Ohio, he still had slaves. But in Ohio, eventually became a freed slave.
Right.
I should say a free state. He kept his slaves, but it was under this weird arrangement where the slaves were not really slaves. They were kind of like indentured servants under contract, but he never renounced ownership during his lifetime of those 12 slaves.
We're going to ding him for that for sure then. All right.
Oh, yeah. So he supported legalizing slavery in the Northwest Ordinance as part of the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Not that he was like involved in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. He basically was like, hey, that allows us to... He was in Indiana at the time. That when that ordinance came about, it allowed him to... You know, more or less, it allowed for the continuation of slavery.
Yeah.
But he started to shift. You know, sometimes he started to shift to this more kind of emancipationist viewpoint of like eventually slavery should be, you know, naturally outlawed. What makes him a little different than say like a Jefferson is that he never really continued to buy slaves. Like Jefferson expanded the amount of slaves he had. So did Jackson. You know, he kind of he teeters that like Monroe, Madison. Well, he's more Monroe. Like, I grew up with this. This is a function of the economy. And maybe he was kind of a lot blind, I would say, to the morality of it. But he gets a lot of points dinged because he, like, you know, dude, he brought slaves to a free area and argued for the expansion of slavery. I don't want to, like, gloss over that.
Well, I was hoping that the move to Ohio was kind of like where we start to see maybe that turn, or like maybe he didn't take them with him. Maybe he let them go at that point. But no, that's not what happened. So, okay.
Yeah, he's, you know, he did eventually, and something that he was trying to appeal to the Southern Whigs as he started running, and he did push for, slavery to be decided as a state issue, and this is where you started to see that angle towards emancipation, being an emancipationist. I think a lot of contemporary historians, I don't think they would consider him an emancipationer. I think without radical everybody is, he would probably come off as an emancipationist, but I don't think we would say that.
That's probably what his opponents were saying about him, just to try to drum up headlines, but it doesn't sound like that would be the case, no.
Yeah, and so they ended up actually downplaying his views on slavery when he was running, because while he was trying to appeal to the Southern Whigs, there was also like the Whig Party was made up of a lot of abolitionists.
Right,
a lot of
right.
money was coming from the Northeast, which was straight up like they were radical abolitionists.
Yep.
They were like, end slavery now, any yes. means necessary.
Right.
And they're like, well, we'll secede. It's like, yeah, we said any means necessary. I don't know why. Good. Thank you for telling us how we would like to do it.
Okay. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. Like, it is wild that, like, that was not, it's one of those things where you learn it in school. You think that that's something that happened in 1860. And now it's like, you can read guys in the 1820s being like, let's just fight a war. Can we fight? It's like, you want to fight your fellow countrymen? It's like, yeah, no, this is an issue we're willing to fight over. It's like, if there's any issue to be fought over, it feels like this one should be.
Yeah, this feels like a good one.
Yeah,
good
it feels like the issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he serves two terms as a representative from Ohio. He then comes back. They ask him to, he gets voted to the Ohio State Senate at the time. You know, really, he's at this point, he's just a war hero. Like, he's a war hero, national prominent. He's considered a very good administrator. People love him. He really enjoys, he really enjoys the administrative part of government. And then loses a congressional bid in 1822.
Oh, no.
Just goes and runs for the U.S. House again. He kind of thinks he's going to win pretty easily. Everything's going to be win pretty easily. Ends up losing. So he's like, oh, that's weird. But by 1824, he's now kind of firmly an active Whig, right?
Okay.
So this is, remember, it's 1824. So this is before Jackson, right?
This is during JQA's presidency, right?
Yes. Yeah, so this is proto Whigs, you'd kind of call it, maybe like National Republican E. And this is where we start seeing the ending of the era of good feelings.
Yeah.
So by 1825, he's a U.S. senator. So he couldn't become a rep, but he waited a few years to become a senator. and he's chosen by, and you know, he's chosen by the legislators. And he actually served in different diplomatic posts. So he was kind of getting to know different people.
Kind of like a JQA kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
My next name I was going to say is JQA. So JQA, following his dad's footsteps, takes a real big like to William Henry Harrison. And he turns and appoints. This is a story we talked about too earlier on, which is John Quincy Adams appoints Mr. William Henry Harrison. I didn't actually bring this up at the time because I thought it was kind of interesting, to be the minister to Grand Colombia. And if you remember, big controversy on like recognizing countries in Latin America. So he sends him down there.
That's who he sent down?
Yeah, he sent down William Henry Harrison. No. And he meets, who does he meet and becomes like actually pretty good friends with? Simón Bolívar.
The name of the currency of Gran Colombia, right?
Yeah.
It's still and Bolivia's currency right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's also Venezuela's.
Also probably what Bolivia was named after.
Yeah, you know, he's like considered the founding father for all these North South American nations. He gets recalled by Andrew Jackson. By the time he leaves, he's like Jacksonians in like full blow. He's like, oh crap, this is like, if you could think of two people who don't mesh well, I would say it'd be Harrison and Jackson. Ironically, Harrison was probably like, oh, my battles actually mattered.
We were in a war when I fought.
Oh, you saved New Orleans from nothing because the war was over. I freed Detroit, which was a much more important city. During the war, using good logistics and not being insane.
Did he fire a shot? I don't know.
No, I don't think he did. I gotta look that up. There might have. I don't believe that. I think it was a strategic withdrawal.
Yeah.
By the way, some of the stuff I ran into, and again, I only have one source for some of this stuff, so I always like preface this with like I read, and when I say I read, I'm speaking like I specifically read one thing. is the Brits were like, oh, he's wicked smart. They're like, oh, he's a good general. Like he knows where to be. He doesn't fall into traps. He's not overly aggressive. So there's like a lot of admiration. They're like, oh, he's a good general, dude. He's not vicious. He's not mean. He's just a great tactician. And his like idea of the best battle is a battle not fought, which is scary because when he would fight battles, he was pretty efficient. They're like, oh, he doesn't want to fight me. But if he does fight me, he's kind of like an Omar Bradley. We're like Patton. Jackson was more of a Patton. Like, I want to fight you. I want to know you're fighting me. Bradley's like, I want to beat you. And you go home with all your ammo. Like, that's the ideal win.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you just beat me. I can't even fight. Like, you beat me.
It's like winning a chess game without taking a single piece.
Yeah. I do like the idea, too, that, like, I read, like, two military, not, like, papers. I guess they're papers. Like, two military papers. And they kind of beat around the bush because I don't want to say it. But, like, it's straight up, and I've been using it nonstop. It's maneuver warfare. Like, he's fighting a maneuver warfare. He's like, that's where the Battle of Tippecanoe, which we'll obviously cover, gets really interesting is because it's like, it's maneuver warfare. So here's where it gets cool. So he leaves his Senate seat, and he's like, this is 1829. He gets appointed. Leaves the Senate seat to be appointed to Grand Colombia. Leaves Grand Colombia, gets recalled March 1829. And so he decides, he goes, do you know what? And I actually mentioned this in my TED Talk, not to my TED Talk.
Which one?
He served in local government. So after being a senator and the ambassador to one of the largest countries in the Western Hemisphere, he went back and took a job as the clerk of courts at Hamilton County.
I kind of love that, actually.
Yeah, he used the time to kind of rebuild his finances from all the traveling he did. And he was known to be this, like, awesome guy people like to deal with. People in Cincinnati and North Bend loved him. And he was just like, I'm kind of happy. So naturally, immediately, he serves there for 5 years. And as he, you know, he's like, hey, you know, starts looking at reentering the political environment. And much like his other record, where he loses an election, then becomes a senator, he goes from being the clerk of courts to the U.S. president.
Yeah, see, this guy likes to skip the line, that's what it seems like.
Yeah, he just, they were like, hey, now the Whig Party has fully formed. It's not just proto-Whigs, National Republicans. And they were like, hey, we want to run all these different people. We're going to try, like, you know, they kind of had, we would consider a primary. I guess we would consider it the first. There are some people who say the Whig election of 1836 was the first true primary. There's an argument there both ways. Like, I would never chastise somebody for saying it wasn't. I think it was, but that's Eric's opinion. That is not, like, consensus.
Right.
And they ran a bunch of regional candidates, and it was done, actually, to force a contention election. So it was done to, like, force a kind of primary.
Okay.
And Harrison, he finished huge. He carried several states. He was second in popular votes. Did a good job. Yeah, so obviously he doesn't win the election of 1836. Martin Van Buren does, but he runs for president, right? It's like, my next stop's U.S. president. Election of 1840 comes around. They hold the Whigs convention. It's held in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So William Henry Harrison, election of 1840 comes around. They end up having the National Whig Convention. It's in Harrisburg. A couple different balloting back and forth. But at the end of the day, the Whigs are very happy. William Henry Harrison wins. Kind of weird. So he definitely wanted John Tyler as his vice president, but they also, like, confirmed him. This is the first time we see mass mobilization tied to an election. And so you see, like, people, little groups in each state campaigning for their president, but part of a national platform. What you see today, this is the first time this was done, is election of 1840. He ends up becoming this plain spoken folk hero of the frontier, Tippecanoe and Tyler too.
Right.
And turned a lot of the jabs. People would say, oh, he's a log cabin, you know, oh, the hard cider, all those things. People would, like, make fun of him for liking those things. He's like, who doesn't like a log cabin and hard cider? He's like, these sounds like awesome things.
Right.
He has a good plan to deal with we're in the panic of 1837. He has a good plan. He's all about fiscal stability. He has this huge resume going all the way back to the early first decade of the 1800s of doing this. They see this guy who's, like, well managed these states. They see all this great stuff. They're like, they believe him. And, you know, it's like, you've lied to them. It didn't go around long enough.
Right.
He hands Van Buren a very decisive, he wins the popular vote, the electoral college vote, and ends up becoming president in March 4th of 1841. And we'll end it in this part. Obviously, Kyle, if you have anything to yell at me about, you, it's your show, you can do it. He enters the White House on a firm promise. I will only serve one term.
And he held that promise.
So there we are. There is everything you didn't learn about William Henry Harrison in 7th grade.
And less than 60 minutes, which I think is pretty well done.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely as good a place as any to put a pin in this episode. So you can join us next week as we miraculously still have Harrison content to get through. And if somehow we did manage to forget to cover something, please drop it in the comments for the world to see. You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. And make sure you visit our other website, chinashopproductions.com, because we've got a ton of other content on there that'll keep you busy until we meet again next week. Boom.